From India's largest newsroom, I'm Meenal Bagheel, and this is the Times of India podcast. This has been a year of tumult in Indian politics, with crucial state assembly elections in Bengal, Assam, Tamil Nadu, and Kerala, the farmers' agitation and the government's capitulation, the deepening of the Hinduization of our polity, all of them in a way also signposting the road ahead. I asked Suhas Palshikar, eminent political scientist, academic and commentator, to take the political temperature of the year in this podcast. Palshikar, who is co-director of the Lokniti program on comparative democracy, earlier this year co-edited a book on politics and society between elections with Siddharth Swaminathan. In this wide-ranging interview, Suhas Palshikar speaks about the idea of a Hindu Rashtra and how close is India to it. He also talks about political pragmatism of coalition rather than grand ideological counter as the only way forward for the opposition and about the hard political choices that face India's Muslims. Mr. Palshikar, you wrote recently in the Indian Express in your column that after the inauguration of the Kashi Vishwanath corridor, that it signaled a formal beginning of putting in place something akin to a Hindu Rashtra. We have also, of course, recently in the last 2-3 days, been seeing the terrible meeting that happened of the Hindu Vahini Sena at Haridwar, and we're calling for the killing of Muslims. I want to ask you, that is the idea of a Hindu Rashtra now seeming like an inevitability to you? And what is its larger appeal?
I think the larger appeal, and I would address that first, because the larger appeal is that for many Hindus, it seems logical enough that if there are majority of Hindus in India, then India by definition would be a Hindu society and a Hindu nation. That idea seems to have percolated to many sections of the society, not just a few literate ones or politically aware ones. And that's why I think that that idea has become so popular. About inevitability, yes, in a sense for the next decade or so, I see this trend to continue. Because it's not something which has happened only in the last one decade or 7 years of the current regime. There is a long history of 100 years, but more than 100 years, there is a history of last 25 to 30 years. If every decade you see, then you will find that 2000 decade was marked by the Gujarat violence. The 90s decade was marked by the destruction of Ayodhya. And through these decades, in a sense, this idea has percolated to a larger audience and has become popular that we are Hindus, which is problematic in the first place because all Hindus are actually belonging to different sects, different faiths. They worship different gods and goddesses. But there has been a homogenization of what is called a Hindu. And then secondly, this claim on the political territory that because we are Hindus in a majority, the political territory belongs to Hindus. That's the larger and rather complicated logic that seems to be working at a popular level.
It's not enough to be Hindu. It's also important to be militant. Where is that originating from? Because Hinduism, as you yourself said, there are many sects and there's a lot of intellectualism, there's a lot of ambiguity, fluidity that the religion offers.
My response to that is that this is typically un-Indian and un-Hindu. In a sense, Hindus, that is to say Hindu sects, have fought with each other historically, both in intellectual terms, but sometimes they have come to battles, physical battles with each other as well. Take the case of the Shaivas and the Vaishnavas, or the case of the Buddhists and the various other sects that then left the Hindu fold philosophically, and then who claim that they are now no more Hindus but different religious denominations. However, this idea that if you are a Hindu, then you have to show your Hindu-ness and therefore a public display in the first place.
Yes.
And then secondly, the second step is that being Hindu means being aggressive, being militant in your assertion of being Hindu. I refer to 1990s because that was the time when middle class people at least started putting this sticker on their doors, garv se kaho hum Hindu hai. Garv, of course, in Hindi does not necessarily have a pejorative meaning, but garv se kaho also brings this idea that you have to assert your Hindu-ness, and that assertion is vis-a-vis something. It is only in opposition to someone that my Hindu-ness gets defined. And that's the current tragedy of being a Hindu, that my Hindu-ness is not about my faith, my worshipping, my prayers. It is more in reference to the other. In a sense, I find, therefore, that there is some element of truth, criticisms apart, some element of truth in the argument which has been made in many quarters that political Hindutva is different from a philosophical or practiced Hinduism.
But the appeal of this political Hindutva is very strong.
Yes.
Because it's also simpler.
Sure, it is.
How does, if one were to counter it, is any countering at all possible, philosophically and politically?
Frankly, liberals, those who critique Hindutva, have missed the bus already because they never appreciated this difference between religiosity, which I may like or not, is an inevitable trait of people everywhere in the world. They also missed the idea that in every religion, and therefore in Hindu religion also, there would be many great philosophical insights which one has to capture. That has been lost. In a sense, you throw the baby with the bathwater. That is what has happened. And therefore, to now resurrect that, one will have to go back at two levels. One is a larger project of enlightenment, public reasoning. And the other is the search for genuine, authentic, and inward-looking Hinduism. Those who believe that they are Hindus have to take the second task. Those who claim that they are liberals have to emphasize on the former task of enlightenment.
And what kind of an ideological clarity do you think that the BJP has about a Hindu Rashtra? Do they see it as a theocratic state or what the Westerners would call ethnic democracy? Is that their project?
You know, there is a clarity, and yet I sometimes believe that there is no clarity as well. The kind of political Hindutva one sees being unleashed currently, like at Haridwar, for example, is not something that the RSS chief, Mr. Mohan Bhagwat, would at least for the time being propagate. His idea would be more close, RSS and therefore current idea from Devras onwards and Mohan Bhagwat's idea would probably be closer to what you refer to as ethnic democracy, where a particular religious community is seen as an ethnic unit. And therefore, all Indians are Hindus. Those who are not Hindus have to acquiesce themselves, have to accommodate themselves in the corner spaces that are allowed. But otherwise, they will not be hounded. They will be allowed to live. It's a bad, this is a bad, bad version of a very bad version of the melting pot model. That you melt, or if you want to remain separate, you are allowed, but within limits. That's one model. The other model is Islamophobia. And I think they feed into each other, and that is where the connect comes. The main objective, as you said, is obviously ultimately to create an other Then to homogenize the Hindus, and to homogenize Hindus is a very un-Hindu idea. It has been adopted from missionary Christian ideas of coming together and creating a congregation. However much the Hindutva politics might despise the public display of namaz, the ideal is precisely that. That Hindus should be doing similarly a public display of their religiosity.
The ideal that you're talking about that the RSS wants to propagate is that, you know, everybody is a Hindu and those who are not should know their place. And that, but you see, what is the place? Because there are now multiple outfits who are announcing us, you know, that you can't conduct namaz, or you can't, you know, have Christian missionary prayer halls. There's anti-conversion. So it's not as if that the second-class citizen's place is fixed in their minds.
No, you're right. Going back to the earlier point about ethnic democracy, in fact, discussions about ethnic democracy get stuck up precisely at this point as to what is the place of the other ethnicities in the so-called ethnic democracy. And therefore, the scholars studying ethnic democracy are asking precisely this question, whether it is a democracy at all, or whether it is in a sense an oxymoron, because if you are thinking of the predominance of one community, then how can there be democracy? Because then there can't be an equal relationship. So yes, you are right. The first step would be to say that there would be Hindu domination. The second step would be to push the non-Hindus into a corner. The third space would be to then enforce some kind of a cultural and economic embargo on them. We in India are setting up a very bad example of what and how not to handle diversity for the world. If a large section of global population like the Indian society really does something that we are currently doing, then we would be contributing greatly to the larger project of the 21st century, which is the slide down of democracy.
We are with great pomp celebrating the Amrit Mahotsav of 75 years of Indian independence, and yet denying everything that ERA stood for. How is this project being sold, you think?
If you look at the website of the Amrit Mahotsav, Azadi Ka Amrit Mahotsav website, you will find that there is very little actually about the ideological content of that struggle which went on for over 100 years. There are mentions of persons who fought for Azadi. That mention is somewhat magnanimous in some places, but the point is, it's the intellectual content. The intellectual content is on being Atmanirbhar, looking forward, and looking at the creation of New India. So in a sense, we are creating, through Azadi Ka Amrit Mahotsav, we are creating an amnesia about what Azadi meant for our ancestors, our forefathers, and those who struggled for that Azadi. We are also creating a contemporary amnesia about what Azadi means for people of India today, and creating an entirely new paradigm. And that is how it is being sold. If you one by one listen to these speeches by the leader himself and by other leaders of the party that is currently in power, you will find how this Azadi Ka Amrit Mahotsav, or even other legacy, the larger legacy of the national movement, is being simply tucked away into the backdrop, and something new is being created. Tactically and strategically, this is, in a sense, extraordinary politics. So the political skills must be admitted with the rider that those skills are being spent for a very dangerous project in terms of democracy.
The message that is coming is that contemporary Indians are involved in another struggle of creation of a new independent India, independent from elitism and certain families.
That is an exaggerated assessment, I would say. There is always an argument made that elites have ruled this country and now people are coming up, etc. But among the people, that populist sentiment is far more limited than one would have expected. Of course, there are many meanings and meanings of the term populism, but broadly, it means anti-elitism, then creating an other and an anti-institution approach, that institutions are a hindrance, processes and institutions are not democracy, invocation of people in place of institutions. So what we did, and this is a study which Lokniti did with Azim Premji University over a period of 3 years, the report has come out in the form of a book currently. What we did was we asked people questions about all these three dimensions of populism. And we find that while people are attracted to this anti-elite discourse, the other two elements are not very popular among the general public. While, as I said, on the other hand, if you look at Indian politics always has had this style of populist politics. It's not only today that it is happening, though today it is happening in a much more sophisticated and skillful manner. We have had populist leaders who adopted populism as a form of relating to the public. So this anti-elitism was something which actually brought N.T. Rama Rao into the limelight, for example. The difference between that and today's populism, however, is that those earlier populisms emerged and then tamed down. The current populism seems to have emerged and established as an ongoing, continuous style of politics.
Coming to the Prime Minister and the way his image has been changing since 2014. And while, of course, it is easy to say that he's appealing to the Hindu sentiment, etc., but there's also this very real issue of this reaching welfare, this last mile welfare. How important do you think it is in his popularity? Because his, undeniably, his personal popularity is quite stupendous.
One must admit that the schemes that are supposed to be reaching the last mile or the last person, whether they are reaching or not, can always be contested. But that is an important part of this current regime. And the current regime, in a sense, therefore, stands on both these. Wherever applicable, it would use the welfare measures as its publicity material. However, my argument still would be that that would not get the Prime Minister and his party the extra votes which are required in very deeply contested electoral battles. And that is why they are so keen on this image of the Prime Minister and the party as Hindutva. You will recall that in 2014, they did not require it, mainly because they also then relied on the bad publicity of the UPA. They relied on, in a sense, the bad record of the UPA. Today, they can't rely on that anymore. And that is why we will find that increasingly, since 2019, the emphasis is on this. Or let me put it this way. In the first 5 years, the clear division was that the Prime Minister and the government would concentrate, focus on governance and development and leave the cultural assault to the so-called fringe. That is to say, the non-government wings of the party. They would do that. Since 2019, the government has taken over that aspect as well, to intervene in the cultural spaces and to create not just the Hindu nation, but what I have called the Hindu state. A de facto Hindu state is now being created since 2019. And that is because, not just for electoral purposes, I won't relate it to only electoral purposes. I am sure the Prime Minister can win elections only with their electoral machine. The larger point is that their assessment must have been this, that now is the time when a step further is necessary. So if you find Vajpayee's government not doing any of these things, that was natural enough because they were not in a position politically to do it. The Modi government of 2014 first thought that it must create its base, which it did during the first 5 years. I think now the phase has come when they would come out in the open and say, yes, this is a Hindu nation, and therefore within the present constitution, and if necessary by undermining that constitution, we will create a Hindu political setup here. That is what the government is now doing.
You have, of course, in the past written about that a counter to this idea can come from India's federalism, from the states. And we did see it. I mean, there are several southern states, and most visibly we saw it in Bengal. Are you still invested in that idea?
It's not a question of my investment. What I'm saying is that what other sources do we have? As I said earlier, a larger project of maybe a new renaissance of the Indian society cannot really contest politically and immediately. There is the here and now in politics. Politics cannot wait for enlightenment to arrive 25 years later. The second thing which I pointed out is about Hindu religion. And I don't see Hindu religion internally reformulating itself vis-a-vis the current assault on it by Hindutva forces. The third point is that, being a student of politics, my usual first point of reference naturally would be, how do you politically contest this? And obviously then one has to find out the political spaces, whether it is in 2019 or in 2024 or now next year when UP elections will happen. A political setback would put brakes to what is happening in the cultural domain. I know and I agree that even a defeat of the BJP will not, in a sense, undo what they have already done. And yet at the same time, I would argue that while an inadequate remedy is there, with all its inadequacy, the first remedy will have to be political remedy. I read the farmers' agitation as that setback. Though the terrain is entirely different, the context was different, the fact that the Prime Minister had to step back is an indication that ordinary politics can still happen, and this current regime can be politically sort of checkmated or at least put in its place. But that was momentary. It has now been forgotten in a sense within just last fortnight or so. And therefore, federalism in this sense, that states asserting themselves, can probably help in creating a new center-state schism which would force the current regime to be on its guard. Tamil Nadu, West Bengal, Kerala are possibilities for this reason. Andhra Pradesh, Telangana and Odisha are disappointments for the same reason.
So the pandemic, in a sense, has been bookended by the CA and RC protests and the farmers' protests. And they seem to be taking the place of opposition rather than political parties. Recently, I was hearing an interview by Prashant Kishore where he said that what is to say that there cannot be a contestation within opposition parties to emerge as which one should be the principal opposition party? What do you make of that?
I will keep Prashant Kishore out. Okay. But yes, I agree that within political parties which are opposed to the BJP, there will always be, and I don't find anything unnatural in it, there will always be an internal competition and one-upmanship. Because of course, if you were to defeat the BJP, the simple question then would be, who will be in the limelight afterwards? I don't find anything wrong in that. That's bound to happen. With Mamata's victory, her efforts are bound to be there. But my assessment, however, is that there would be limits to what she can do. Look what she is doing. She is trying to enter Goa, Tripura, small states. Small states are always easy to rupture their political equilibrium. The question would come in UP. And there, unfortunately, neither Mamata nor the Congress can really make much of a difference. Suppose for a minute, therefore, that Akhilesh does a good performance in UP. Whether he wins or not is another matter. Then he would start claiming that it is around my party that a larger non-BJP grouping will have to take place. It's a question of politics. Whichever party can win one or two major states will obviously make claims for being the nucleus of this anti-BJP arrangement. If the Congress were to win Gujarat, let's say, a very fantastic imagination, you might say. But if the Congress were to win Gujarat, you will find that the Congress would be suddenly in a position of jockeying the entire non-BJP opposition behind it. So that's how politics is going to run.
Your own home state, Maharashtra, has a very unique coalition of former ideological opponents, now becoming strange bedfellows. What kind of legs does it have? Amit Shah recently said it's a punctured auto rickshaw, the alliance in Maharashtra.
Unfortunately, auto rickshaws, and much more than that, are going to be the order of the day as far as politics are concerned. You can't have Mamata in every state. No political party anywhere is in a position to really defeat the BJP on its own very easily, barring a few states in central India. Even if an election were to take place in Karnataka tomorrow, I think there will have to be some arrangement among different political parties, particularly the two non-BJP players, without which you can't imagine the BJP being challenged, leave aside defeated. How do you conduct post-election politics is actually a matter of political skill. And to the credit of the present punctured auto rickshaw in Maharashtra, as Mr. Amit Shah said, for 2 years, they have at least avoided internal bickering beyond a certain limit. They have survived. And it is this survival which actually is a signal, a warning signal to the BJP that such governments can survive, they can run, and it's another matter whether they run well or not. You can always find faults with governance models of different governments and so on. So, irrespective of the oddity, I think we are living in such times that such odd coalitions are bound to happen. When the BJP first started coalition politics, it actually entered into this oddity itself, publicly saying that because we are doing coalition politics, we will keep aside our core agenda. That is what the BJP said in 96 and in 98 and in 99. So I think that is but natural.
So are you saying we are now in a situation where we can contest the BJP only at a political level, but not quite at an ideological level? There is no ideological counter.
The ideological counter will require a leadership of a very tall order. The ideological counter will also require a lot of intellectual inputs, which are not coming because our academia and our intellectual class generally has crumbled down, and slowly they would be joining the bandwagon. And therefore, we don't find any alternatives coming up except from small corners. And unless there is also a jailing of this politics against the BJP and intellectual arguments against the BJP, unless they come together, the larger cultural movement cannot take place. And as you know, our intellectuals are very fond of keeping their distance from politics, and actually one would take extra efforts to show how they are anti-Congress in order to ensure that their anti-BJPism will not be taken as partisan. It's a time to be partisan, because in these times, to be partisan is to be partisan towards democracy, not towards this party or that political party. And we fail to understand that. Many of my friends, colleagues fail to understand that.
Just a quick final question on Muslim leadership. Now, one of the most visible faces, of course, is Asaduddin Owaisi, who punches above his weight and often gets called the BJP B team, and the disillusionment with Congress's sort of politics of secularism. Where does that leave the Muslim community in India politically?
Let me preface my answer by saying that one has to be very delicate in understanding the Muslim predicament. If one were a Muslim, what politics would you do is an extremely tough question. I admit that. Having said that, tactically, my first response to your question is that tactically, it's bad to counter Hindutva politics by creating separate Muslim party or parties. But it's not only about tactics. I would say that in principle, I would be very skeptical of a Muslim politics or a Muslim political party. Muslim politics has to be part of the larger democratic politics. Either way, you can be either with the communists, with the socialists, with the Congress, or whatever party you might. In other words, therefore, what I'm saying in response to the basic question is that any separate Muslim party will always benefit the BJP. And therefore, Muslim politics will have to be, in spite of its problems, integrated with other non-BJP politics.
Today's episode is produced by Jairaj Singh and Sunay Marathe. For a daily spotlight on people, ideas and stories that matter, subscribe to us. We are available on TOI Plus, Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts and all other platforms of your choice. For any news tips, reach us at toipodcasts@timesinternet.in.